It's a pleasure to have Reverend Carl Castle, president of Pinewood Junior College, with us this evening. I'm going to ask him if he'll open for prayer, and for us for prayer. Thank you.
Our Heavenly Father, we are very thankful that this world, your creation, you conceived it and planned it and made it. We thank you for the marvels that we know about it now, and also for the marvels that are yet to be discovered. We thank you for the opportunity to learn a bit about your work in it tonight. We want to thank you also for the man who brings us this lecture, the intensity that he demonstrates to look at your world through the scripture and through the best knowledge that we can generate about your world. The help that he has been to many in his work. We pray, Lord, that you would enable him to be of help to each of us here this evening. We ask our God that you would meet with us and make this a profitable time. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you. This is the first of our sessions in the Spring 92 series of our IBRI colloquia. If it doesn't feel like spring yet, patience, in a couple of months it will. We're happy to have Dr. Perry Phillips speak to us on the topic, Do Continents Move? Dr. Phillips has an undergraduate degree in physics from Beloit College, his doctorate in experimental astrophysics at Cornell, and then received a Master of Divinity here at Biblical Seminary, and then went over to Jerusalem, where he received a Master of Arts in Hebrew, and taught for a couple of years, I believe, as the guide for the biblical geography field trips at the American Institute of Holy Land Studies. He has taught at Pinebrook Junior College now for 11 or 12 years, sounds about right, and has taught both astronomy and geology. So he has experience in astronomy. You might wonder what that's got to do with continental drift, but we'll find out. And geology and geography. And he has stood on several continents, different continents, while they've been moving around. So I think he is competent to discuss the question, do continents move? Perry.
I must say, even though I have stood on continents that have been moving around, I have not experienced the movement firsthand. One very wise person once said that when you get up to speak before a group, there are three questions that the group is always asking of you that you have to answer. The first one is, so what? The second one is, who cares? And the third one is, what difference does it make? I hope to answer a few of these questions as we proceed with the talk, but just to start out a little bit, why study this particular subject besides the reason that it is just personally interesting and fascinating? I've listed several reasons. First of all, just the need to be generally well-rounded, educated person. There's a lot being said about education today. And it seems to me that there are certain basic facts, some of them scientific, that I think everybody ought to know. I think everybody ought to know that the Earth is round. They ought to know that it's the Earth that goes around the sun. I think everybody should know some basics about atomic structure. You all, of course, know the basics of atomic structure. And in the same token, it seems to me that everybody should have an idea as to why there are many people who study the Earth that feel that the continents are actually in motion. And we will discuss some of the reasons. And so just part of being a generally well-rounded, educated person would seem to me that that would involve some knowledge about the movement of continents. The second reason, it really explains some major topographic and geologic features that we have here on Earth. For example, volcanoes are not evenly scattered about the surface of the Earth. There are various locations that have very strong volcanic activity, just as there are discrete locations where one finds a number of earthquakes. Earthquakes appear in some regions and not in others. Not only do we have volcanic and earthquake regions, but also if you take a good look at the map, what you will find is that many of the mountain chains not only the continental chains, but also the oceanic chains, are what we call linear chains. That is to say, they go in a line. They weave around the Earth, but they go in a line. The question is, why is this? Why aren't mountains scattered throughout the whole surface of the Earth? One of the chains is in our west. You can actually start up in Alaska and follow the mountains down through the Canadian Rockies, the American Rockies, all the way down through Central America, and right along the west coast of South America. And, of course, the question arises, why is that? And then the fourth geographic feature that is very interesting are some of these incredibly deep oceanic trenches that are found in the Pacific Ocean, not in the Atlantic, but in the Pacific. Some of these trenches are deeper than Mount Everest is high. How did they form? Why are they there? So these are reasons that I would want to discuss continental drift, because we will find that continental drift really explains the discrete locations of many of these features on the Earth. And then also, continental drift is a great way to understand how science works. Science works on the basis of experiment, theory generation, rechecking the theory with more experiments, refinement upon the theory, checking it again. And I think we'll see with continental drift a good fit between theory and experiment. And then finally, any discussion on the age of the Earth, which is a hot topic in many Christian circles, any discussion on the age of the Earth also has to account for the evidence that is brought up in favor of continental drift. If the evidence for continental drift is correct, if the interpretation is correct, it implies that the Earth is relatively old. If it is not correct, then we'll have to see what evidence can be adduced to show that the major features that continental drift explains can be explained in the young Earth framework. So for all of these reasons, it seems to me that this is a worthwhile topic to discuss. Let me begin a little bit with a brief history. The second person, the person that you see listed here in Part B, A Brief History, Alfred Wegener, is generally credited as beginning the modern movement towards thinking that continents actually move, but actually there were some earlier ideas that were around, especially as people began to understand what the shape of the continents were on the Earth and how they might fit together. Let me show you with the first slide. Even back in the time of Francis Bacon, which would be the 1600s, and even a little later than that, people began to recognize that it was possible to fit continents together a little bit like a jigsaw. If you look at this map from the bottom up, you are actually looking at a map that Alfred Wegener put together. But this shows the ideas that other individuals had when they looked at a map of the Earth. They saw that if you were to take the continents as they are today and move them around a little bit, you can fit things together pretty well. As I said, even back in Francis Bacon's time, around 1615 or so, he began to wonder if the continents at one time were together. Along with that as well, there was another man at that time by the name of Antonio Snyder. What he found is that here's his map. What he found is similar phenomenon that Alfred Wegener talked about, and that is he could take South America and the eastern part of South America and fit it in pretty well to the western part of Africa and get this conglomerate map that you have over on the left-hand side. We have already talked about Alfred Wegener. He was the one who was responsible for the modern movement towards continental drift. He had a large amount of evidence that he gave in favor of the theory, and I'll discuss that evidence in a moment. Alfred Wegener was kind of an eccentric. He fought in the First World War and was injured a couple times, and while he was recuperating in bed, he began to think about the surface of the Earth. And while he was recuperating, he began to put a lot of his ideas together and plans as to how to go about and try to show that continents at one time were together and they had moved. He was one of the first to realize that this particular study is cross-disciplinary, that it would not only take knowledge of continents, it would take knowledge of biology, it would take knowledge of oceanography, and he began to take the information that had been gathered in these various disciplines and start putting it together to come up with a coherent theory of what we call continental drift or the movement of continents. Alfred Wegener was not an armchair geologist. He went out there and made many of the observations himself. He took trips to Greenland, traversed across the width of Greenland. Unfortunately, Greenland is also where he lost his life in an attempt to save some other people that were in an exploration party with him. And in 1928, he took off from a base camp wanting to reach the shore in order to bring in more supplies and help to save some of his comrades. Unfortunately, he lost his life in the process of doing that. What are some of the evidence that Alfred Wegener had to propose the idea that continents actually move? We've already mentioned the maps that he had. But it isn't just the fitting together of the continents that attracted his attention. It was also various features on the continents. Here you find South America and Africa put together, and the various dots represent various features of the land, various geologic features of varying ages. So when you take a good look at what is happening here on the east coast of South America and the western coast of Africa, you see some regions that seem to overlap. For example, over here, where Brazil meets the Congo area, you have a little overlap of the green area here, and you have more overlap of the orange area. And basically what he saw is two continents that are separated by a few thousand miles with some very similar features. And he had a hard time believing that the geologic features would develop on each continent independently. On the other hand, he could see that if the two continents were together at one time, as his map would show, he could understand how you could have this overlap of the features. It wasn't just geologic features dealing with age, but a number of other features as well, as is tried to illustrate with this particular map. Down below where the arrows are in the white, this is the movement of glaciers, which I'll discuss in a moment. But if you look at some of the yellow regions, you find desert areas, and the green band that goes across the middle of the map deals with the more of a tropical area. And again, he had a hard time explaining how these features could exist independently when the continents were so far apart, but if at one time they were together, he could see how you could have a migration of plants and animals across these regions so as to give you the uniformity that you have in this particular map. Also, I mentioned the overlap of some of the ages. Some of the geologic features also overlap. Here in the dark brown, you have what are known as areas of flood basalts. These are areas where basaltic rock, a kind of heavy volcanic rock, comes to the surface and spreads across the area and basically floods the region. And the interesting thing is that the flood basalts in South America and Africa look very similar, along with the ones that are in Antarctica and Africa, and over in India and Madagascar. And he puzzled as to how the flood basalts across large spans of ocean would be so similar. But he thought if these continents were together, when the flood basalts actually oozed out of the earth, then one could explain how the flood basalt would flood both continents. And then later, when the splitting took place, some of the flood basalts would be taken on one continent, and the others would go along with the other. Here, by the way, is a picture of flood basalts out in our Columbian River area in Oregon and Washington. And you can see this layer of flooding rock, molten rock, that came out to the surface and flooded. Not only is that interesting that the flood basalts are so similar, but geologists talk about a geologic column. That is to say, if you were to dig a deep trench into the surface of the earth, you would come across layers of varying rocks. And here are so-called trenches that have been dug in South America on the left and Africa on the right. Actually, these aren't trenches, but these are areas where rivers have cut through layers of rocks, and the geologists can actually go and see the layers of rocks. And you notice that when you compare South America and Africa, you find that the various layers of rock that have been dated at different times correlate. The only difference is up on top, down about 50 million years, where in one region you have a desert, basically the African Saharan, and over in the west, in South America, you have the tropics, basically Brazil. But below that region, below this region here, some 50 million years, you find a direct correlation. Here's some of the flood basalts I've been talking about. And as these rock layers are dated to later or earlier and earlier times, more and more years from us, you find a direct correlation. Coal seams, drifting sands, flood basalts, etc. Well, it is hard to believe that the same events would occur on two continents that are separated by 2,000 miles at exactly the same time so as to give this correlation. On the other hand, if the continents were together while all these features were formed, and then later the continents split apart to give you the difference that you have up here in the last 30 million years, then this makes sense. And this is one of the stronger evidence that Wegener was able to adduce. I mentioned that Wegener also looked at the glaciation that had occurred in various parts of the Earth. Here are striations and grooves that have been produced by glaciers as a result of the ice flowing across a body of rock and scraping out, gouging out, ravines and grooves as a result of the rock that is embedded in the ice. This feature, these grooves, allow one to see the direction of the glaciers. And not only that, but looking at what are known as chatter marks, which you see down in this region, we can tell not only the orientation of the glacier, but whether it is moving from left to right or right to left. Now, here's what's interesting. Take a look, if you will, at the top map. These white areas represent glacial features that were investigated by Wegener and which he correlated. And as a result of looking at the direction at which the glaciers flowed, notice here in South America, the flow is from the ocean inland, from a low area to a high area. We don't know of glaciers forming in water. Glaciers form on land and then move out to the water as the ice moves downhill. But if the glaciers actually formed in the water, what it would mean is they would be moving uphill towards some mountains. Not only that, but part of the glaciation would be just below the equatorial belt. And it's hard to understand that if South America was in that location at all times, how glaciers would be forming around the equatorial belt. Look at Africa. Now the equator comes right across here. In Africa, you have the movement of ice in two directions, north and south. Again, it is hard to see how the ice would flow towards the equatorial region if Africa were always in that location. What is really difficult to understand is India and having ice flowing from the ocean up towards the Himalayas. If glaciers are forming in India, one would expect them to form in the upper regions of the Himalayas where it is cold and then slowly begin to migrate down towards the ocean. Here, the direction is just the opposite. And then you find over here in Australia, which is not known as a cold region of the world, again you find glaciers that supposedly would have had to move in off the ocean into Australia. If the continents were always in the location where we find them now, this really would not make a lot of sense. However, if you take the continents and put them together in the puzzle that Wegener suspected, now what you have is down here near the South Pole, where Antarctica is located, it is cold enough to form these monumental continental glaciers. How thick? The ice in Antarctica is thousands of feet thick. 9,000 feet thick. The ice continues to form as yearly snowfalls don't evaporate. The snowfall builds up. Ice forms, and after a while, there is so much weight of ice, it begins to move out. And if the continents were together with a heavy ice formation in this region, then you can understand, if the continents were together, how the ice would move out on the land area that was once together. You can understand how it is from this region,
you would get a bunch of ice forming that moves off into India and off into Australia. And then down here in Africa and South America, you could understand how ice would form in Africa that was farther south at one time near the pole, build up enough ice to force itself into the middle part of Africa and force itself also into South America. And this, again, was one of the very strong evidences that was proposed by Wegener in support of his theory that continents had really moved. By the way, I should say, this particular evidence is also primary evidence today that continents have moved. This is very, very hard to explain by other means. More. We've talked about geologic formations. We have talked about the movement of ice. When one looks at the fossil remains of various fauna and flora, one finds a distribution of creatures and plants that looks like this. Here again is South America, Africa. Over here you have Antarctica. And down here you have Australia. And the various colors with the diagram of the animal and of the plant shows you the distribution of these features. Here's what's interesting. When you take a look at these various animals, like this Mesosaurus here, it's fairly well known that this was a shallow water-dwelling creature. And it's very hard to understand this particular creature, how it could have gone across thousands of miles of open ocean in order to get from Africa to South America or from South America to Africa. On the other hand, if the continents were together, or just beginning to break up where you would have a shallow ocean, then you could understand the movement of the animals across the shallow ocean, which otherwise would be difficult if you had an open ocean that was several thousand feet deep and continents separated by several thousand miles. One of the very interesting plants that has been found spread across from Australia all the way down to South America is this Glossopteris. It has a leaf that looks a little bit like a tongue, and that's why it is called that. This is a plant that likes warmer weather. And it's hard to understand how this would have grown in Antarctica unless at one time Antarctica was a little farther north. Now you say, wait a minute, I thought you said that everything was far south in order to form ice. Now you're telling me that Antarctica was farther north in order to give you a plant that dwells in warm climate. How do you reconcile the two? The answer is that the continents have been moving around, and at one time, they were far enough south in order to form ice. At other times, Antarctica was far enough north in order to form the plant that enjoys the warmer weather. Well, there were several ideas as to how you might be able to explain the fauna and flora distribution. One of them are so-called isthmian links. These are little diagrams that have been drawn by John Holden. They're kind of humorous, but they express the ideas that were around. One of them is the Isthmian Link. The Isthmian Link around today is the one right across Central America that connects North America and South America, and you have quite a flow of flora and fauna across there. And so in the northern part of South America, you get plants and animals that are similar to what you find in the southern part of North America. And people thought perhaps it is that the continents really are where they are now, but what you had is these land bridges that connected the continents, connected Africa and South America, connected North America and Europe. Where are they now? Well, the ocean now is higher than what it was back then, and a lot of these land bridges now, it was thought, have been submerged. Another idea was rafting. In terms of being able to explain how you get the same kind of plant across large expanses of ocean, the idea would be that a number of these things floated across. It is known that plants and animals can float across large widths of water. However, it is hard to believe that you could explain the distribution of the animals from South America all the way to Australia and down to Antarctica by rafting. The third proposal was the island stepping stones, that basically you had rafting between islands, and then from one island to another island to another island, and eventually you were able to build up your flora and fauna population across many, many miles of ocean. Again, if this is the case, the question that arises is, where are these islands? Again, they are submerged. Now, let me just mention, in terms of the islands and in terms of the Isthmian links, the land bridges, further investigation of the ocean has not found them there. And we'll see that the ocean is far different than what you would expect if indeed the flora and the fauna were using the land bridges and the islands to get from one continent to the other. Well, that leaves another alternative, and the other alternative is continental drift. And this is kind of humorous because you see these two dinosaurs that have been separated and bawling their eyes out because they will no longer be together. And the broken heart is right up here. This is appropriate since Valentine's Day is just around the corner. Let's take a look at a little more evidence to support continental drift. I mentioned Alfred Wegener as one of the prime movers of continental drift. Maurice Ewing was another mover of continental drift. His particular addition was the so-called echo chamber that he developed, the sonar reflector that was able to be used on ships that looked that were able to discover what the bottom of the ocean looked like. Basically, what you have is a sonar beam that is sent out from a ship that bounces off the bottom of the ocean, and by analyzing the reflected energy that comes back from the sonar beam, they were able to discover what the bottom of the ocean really looked like. Another person is Henry Hess. Hess's contribution was to the so-called seafloor spreading. What really gave a boost in the arm to the whole idea of continental drift was the investigation of the ocean, when people finally began to figure out what is going on underneath the water. And that was a closed book until about the middle of this century. And then with the advent of Ewing's sonar detector and a lot of investigation by Hess and another person whose picture I don't have, J. Tuzo Wilson, a very famous Canadian geologist, a picture of the ocean began to be built up. A picture of the crust of the earth underneath the ocean began to be built up. And using that information, people were able to make great advances on this whole idea of continental drift. You see, in spite of the evidence that Wegener was able to adduce, people did not understand what mechanism would get continents to move. Now, Wegener's idea was that the continents are lighter, made out of lighter, less dense material, and they basically float upon a more dense material, a little bit the way cork floats on water. And his idea was that as the earth turned, there would be a centrifugal force on these continents that would force them to move. And basically what they would move, the lighter continents would move upon this more heavy material. Now, the problem with that is that when calculations were made as to the force on a continent as a result of the Earth's rotation, it was found that that was nowhere enough force in order to get the continents to move. And since there was no mechanism for the continents moving, people basically rejected the idea, and basically thought that Wegener was an eccentric, had some interesting ideas, but not really to be taken seriously. As I say, that whole scenario changed with investigation of what was going on underneath the oceans. And Ewing and Hess and J. Tuzo Wilson are prime movers in that particular scenario. First of all, when the oceans were mapped, it was found that the ocean depths are not uniform, but rather what you have are continents, such as you have in the lighter areas of both sides of this particular photograph. You have a continental margin. And I'll show you a little closer what that is, but this is just the extension of the continent down into the ocean. This is the margin of the continent that has been flooded. And it goes into the ocean very, very gently. And then finally you get to the continental margin that drops off down into the deeper parts of the ocean. And what was interesting, when maps were taken of the region in between Europe and North America and Africa and South America, what they found was a ridge of mountains that are shown in cross-section down here, and this is known as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or the Mid-Oceanic Ridge. This, by the way, is characteristic of other areas in the Earth, not just the Atlantic Ocean. What does that say about continental fitting the continents together? Well, one of the mistakes that was made, and putting the continental jigsaw puzzles together into a puzzle was that the lines that were used to fit them together, to fit the continents together, was the shoreline. And people argued as to whether they had a good fit or not. However, it was realized that what needs to be fit together is the whole continent. And the whole continent really also includes this continental shelf out to the continental margin. Now, this is greatly exaggerated, but you can see what's happening here. The continent slowly slopes into the ocean and then suddenly drops. And people began to realize the place to hook the continents together is over here at the continental shelf, include the continental margin in the map. And when that was done, very fine fits were discovered to exist between the continents that you see here. North America, some of Europe, Greenland's up there, South America and Africa. The blue region represents the continental margin, the continental shelf. The black regions represent overlap between the continental shelf, but interestingly enough, the overlap occurs at the mouth of great rivers, where you would expect overlap to occur because the rivers have deposited a great deal of material farther out on the continental shelf. And the open areas are just basically where the map has not been put together. But this kind of a fit can be done by computer, and you can see when the continental margin is taken into account, the fit is too good to think that the shapes of the continents are the way they are strictly by chance. There's a little too good of a fit there to think it's strictly by chance. Here, by the way, is a map of the region between the Americas and Europe and Africa. And you can see this mountain range that comes down the center. I should say, another good reason for studying continental drift is you learn some geography while you're at it. Interestingly enough, this particular map has been put together from satellite data. And the satellites are able to measure very slight differences in the level of the ocean, the height of the ocean. And through correct analysis, they're able to see what's going on down below. And by using satellites, we've been able to make maps of the ocean. And these maps then are taken and put together in very nice diagrams, such as you see coming from National Geographic. And what is interesting, when all the information is put together, you find that in the middle of the Atlantic, you see this rather broad, narrow, high mountain range that is pretty much in between the various continents that are thought to have drifted apart. Very mountainous. Notice there's a lot of fractures that are perpendicular to the line of the mountains. And all this now has to be taken into account in any theory that tries to explain how the continents have moved apart. And indeed, we'll try to take into account the features that you find here along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And also, we'll try to discuss these kinds of zones in more detail, which gave us more information concerning the splitting of the continents. Well, let me make an excursus here for some theory. And that is to say, let's see, first of all, exactly what we mean by continental drift before we go on and try to explain more of the evidence that is adduced. So this is the bottom of page one, excursus. I talk about the movement of continents. More correctly, I should talk about the movement of plates. It's not just continents that move. The large regions on the Earth move, and these regions that move together are called tectonic plates. And they are shown in this particular diagram with different colors. One of the largest plates is here in the Pacific Ocean. You can see it outlined in this light color, and the arrows that you see represent the direction in which the plates move. The whole surface of the Earth can be divided into a number of these plates, and these plates are thought to be in motion. Upon these plates, you have continents. And as the plate moves, the continents also move. And what you have with the moving plates on the surface of the Earth are regions where the plates are moving apart. And that's what you see here in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, down here in the East Pacific Rise, and in other areas. Plates are moving apart. Those are called divergent zones, or spreading zones, if you wish. If the plates are moving apart in one region, they must be moving together at another region. And those are called convergent zones. And those are shown by the heavier black lines that you have here. Perhaps you can see little arrows on here, which shows you the direction which the plates are moving at the convergent zone. For example, over here, where you have the Eurasian plate and the Pacific plate, you find the arrows up to the left, to the northwest, because if you were there, what you would see is a relative motion of the Pacific plate up against the Eurasian plate. Other places, the boundaries are just moving parallel to one another. They are not moving apart, they are not moving together, but they are moving parallel, and those are so-called transform boundaries, and that is what we have down here in our own west. In fact, that is particular boundary is what gives rise to a lot of earthquakes that you have in California. So these are the particular kinds of zones we want to talk about, the divergent zones, the convergent zones, and the transform zones. Here's a diagram of what these things look like. Upper left, you have the divergent zone, and it is thought that what causes the divergent zone is molten material that comes in from deeper in the earth that rises up, such as you see here, breaks through the solid plate that is on top, and then spreads it apart as the liquid material comes up through. It's known, by the way, that the interior of the earth is hot enough to melt rock, and it's felt that this molten rock from deep in the earth comes up and spreads these plates apart. Here you have a convergent zone. Two things are thought to occur in a convergent zone. One plate dives underneath another, and we will show evidence for that in a few moments. The other possibility that is not shown in this diagram is that two plates come together. None of them dives underneath the other, but basically they both crash together and start building up because of the tremendous force that is involved. It would be a little bit like taking your paper and squeezing it on the ends. You begin to get folding, and these folds on the surface of the earth would be mountain ranges. And one place where this is thought to occur is in the Himalayas, where the Indian plate is moving north up against the Eurasian plate. One is not diving down underneath the other, and both of them are crashing together and just building up and building up and building up, and you have the highest mountains on the surface of the earth. And then the lower diagram represents this transform boundary where two plates are moving parallel to each other. Shown diagrammatically on the surface of the earth, you have two areas that are seen here as divergent zones with the material moving up from the interior of the earth. I'm not talking about the center of the earth, but several hundred miles down, breaking through the crust, pushing the plates apart, and then over here you have a plate that is diving under one. Over here the other plate is diving under another one, and you have the same situation that is occurring over here. This is what we mean by continental drift. This is what we mean by plate tectonics. Again, it's the breakup of the surface of the earth and the various plates that are in motion, and all the action is at the boundaries. Divergent, convergent, or transform. I mentioned that the West is afflicted with earthquakes and with volcanoes. One reason you have a great number of earthquakes between LA and San Francisco is because of the San Andreas Fault. And basically what you have here is the Pacific plate is moving northwest in relationship to the North American plate, or if you like, the North American plate is moving southeast with respect to the Pacific plate. And as these plates move together, there is an enormous amount of friction between them. And they want to grab. But as the pressures continue to build up, eventually the plates jerk. And it's that jerking of the boundaries of the plates that give rise to the earthquakes that you have in California. Another interesting thing that is occurring, however, at this particular plate boundary, a little farther north, here's the transform fault here. Up here you have a convergent zone. And one plate is going under another. We say that is subduction. And the interesting thing here of the subduction is, as the plate descends down into the interior of the earth, it keeps heating up, it begins to melt, and the material that is molten turns out to be lighter than the surrounding material, and begins to move up through the earth, a little bit like releasing oil with an eyedropper underneath water. What's going to happen to the oil? It's going to bob up to the surface. And this lighter material that is melting as a result of the plate's descent is also bobbing up to the surface and forming volcanoes and mountains. And that is what we call the Cascades. Now, the other feature, too, that is interesting is to look at where major trenches occur in the world. These are very deep trenches, and most of them are here in the Pacific. And the interesting thing about these trenches is they occur where the plates are thought to be descending. Take a look again at this diagram. If you have one plate descending underneath another, you're going to have a trench building up in this location. And the western part of the Pacific is thought to be diving underneath the Eurasian plate. And lo and behold, you get a great number of trenches here. The Aleutian Trench, Japanese Trench, Mariana Trench, which is the deepest, goes down about 36,000 feet. Again, it all hangs together very nicely with this kind of a zone. But that's not all. If you plot where various volcanoes occur on the Earth, you find that the volcanoes are also delineated primarily by the plate boundaries. Here are volcanoes. Again, if you look up here, since we keep talking about the northwestern part of the Pacific plate, here you have volcanoes that follow the trenches and then follow this western part of the plate. Over here, you have volcanoes that come all the way down from the Americas, North America, down to South America. Interestingly enough there, we think that there is a subducting zone. And what is interesting is to see how volcanoes are delimited by the plate boundaries. And again, this is what you would expect as a plate begins to die down under another one, it begins to melt, and this molten material, which is less dense, begins to work its way up through the material that's on top, and you begin to get volcanoes next to the trenches. So it all hangs together very, very nicely. Look at earthquakes. Trenches, volcanoes, and now earthquakes are also around the plate margins. These particular earthquake areas are shown in different colored dots to delineate shallow earthquakes from deeper earthquakes. The blue are shallow, the green are intermediate, and the red are very deep earthquakes. Here's a close-up of Japan. Here's the Japanese Trench. These colored dots represent shallow earthquakes. The yellow dots represent intermediate depth earthquakes. And the red dots represent very deep earthquakes. Why do you find these zones of earthquakes with depth? Again, if you think of a convergent boundary, it makes sense. As this rigid plate begins to dive down into the earth, up here where it scrapes up against another plate, you're going to have jarring motion. That's going to produce earthquakes, but they're going to be shallow because the meeting of the two plates is up near the surface of the earth. As the plate continues to descend, part of it moves faster than other part as it gets subducted, and you have motion in the plate, so you're going to have earthquakes all along the plate until finally it descends so deeply that it remelts, and then you don't have anything solid to move to make the earthquake. And so all along the plate as it descends, you're going to find earthquakes, but the depth of the earthquake is going to increase as you move away from the trench in the direction of the plate subduction. And that's exactly, to go back to the previous map, this is exactly what we find over here in Japan. In fact, the Japanese islands have been formed by the remelting of the material as the plate begins to descend and this material comes up to the surface. Japan is a place of many earthquakes. Japan is a place of volcanoes. It all hangs together, doesn't it? In our own Cascades, as I mentioned before, here is Oregon and here is Washington. Right over here is Mount St. Helens. This whole Cascade region is a region of active volcanism, and the reason is because of the subducting plate that is coming down from the so-called Juan de Fuca plate that is diving down underneath the Americas plate. And we all know about Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens will continue to be active as long as the plate continues to descend. But not only Mount St. Helens, Mount Baker, Mount Hood, Mount Shasta, that whole region will continue to be an active volcanic area. Well, we've taken a look at the subduction zones. Let's take a brief look at the divergent zones that are all marked by these lines that you see. Our famous Mid-Atlantic Ridge along here, the East Pacific Rise. What can we say about divergent zones? The evidence that leads us to believe that we have divergent zones fits very nicely with the theory. Here we have convection of old material that occurs under the earth.
As I've mentioned before,
some of it breaks up through the hard crust that's right on top and pushes the plates apart, and then the plates eventually subduct or crash together. What evidence do we have, however, that this process is really occurring where the zones are diverging, where the plates are diverging at the divergent zones? First of all, go back to this particular diagram. As the plate moves apart from this center of upwelling lava, what you would expect is to find that the rock that is produced is older the farther away you move from the center. If you count the molten rock at zero age, then after it hardens, it begins to move away from the center as it is being pushed away by other molten rock. As you move away from the center, symmetrically, what you would expect to find is older and older rock. Now, one of the great success stories of the 50s and 60s was being able to get ships that would be able to drill down through the sediment and the crust of the earth and bring up core samples. And these core samples were dated. And here's one example of what is happening. Here is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge down here between South America and Africa. And these dots that you see on the top map represent various core samples that were taken. Those are plotted down on the bottom, where you have the distance away from the center versus the age. And as you move to greater and greater distances away from the center of the zone, lo and behold, you find a greater and greater age associated with the rock, just as one would expect. Here's just a close-up of the bottom diagram. It shows not only are the ages getting larger, getting greater, but you notice that all these points lie pretty much in a straight line. What that indicates is that the separation of the plates is occurring at a fairly constant rate. And I'll have more to say about that a little later. Not only has this age determination away from the rift, from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, or from the divergent zone, taking place here in the Mid-Atlantic, okay, here's Africa, here's South America, North America, Europe, but you also find a similar kind of feature that occurs here in the East Pacific Rise and over here in the Indian Ocean. Basically, what you have here is a plot where the very dark color represents the rift, and colors that you see moving away from the rift represent different ages. And the very dark color is very young age, and the lighter colors are very old age. And now look at here, when you come in between North America and Europe, you find the rift, which can be seen by the dark color, and notice as you move equal distances east and west, you find the same age, and it's progressively getting older. But how are you going to explain that, other than the material that is welling up in the middle and continuing to move out and just plain gets older as it continues to move away from the divergent zone? Notice that these lines are a little fatter. The colored regions are a little fatter here in the East Pacific Rise. That indicates that the East Pacific Rise is separating faster than the Mid-Atlantic. If you want numbers on this, the Mid-Atlantic separates on an annual basis of about 2 to 2.5 inches, whereas the East Pacific Rise is up to about 5 or 6 inches per year is the separation. Well, you ask yourself, if it's moving away at 2.5 inches a year, how long does it take to build up 6,000 miles? And it turns out to be about 230 million years. Or to put it another way, if this expansion rate has been continuing on a constant, as a constant basis, on a constant amount, when did the continents start to split? And the Atlantic Ocean started splitting apart about 230 million years ago. There's more. If you take a good look at the amount of sediment that you would expect coming up from the ridge, you would find that where the material is very, very young, you would expect very little sediment. That is to say, as rivers continue to pump material into the ocean, ocean currents begin to distribute it throughout the ocean, but eventually this material begins to settle out. You also have a lot of microscopic critters that are growing in the ocean, and when they die, their shells begin to descend. And so you have a constant rain of material down at the bottom of the ocean. Where would you expect great thicknesses of material, and where would you expect very little material? Well, near the divergent zone, that is very, very young, you would expect very little material. As you move away from the divergent zone, where the material is older, where the rock is older, you would expect thicker and thicker sediments. And that is exactly what you see. Here's an illustration of what this would look like, where the various colors represent different ages of the rock and different ages of the sediment. Here's the hard rock that is a part of the plate that's being pushed away from the divergent zone, and the colors of the sediment represent the ages of the rock. And what you find over here, near the rift, these divergent zones are also called rift zones, what you find is very little sediment, and as you move away from the divergent zones, you find more and more and more sediments in keeping with what one would expect. Here, by the way, is a picture of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, one region of it. This kind of rock that is extruded here is called pillow lava. This is characteristic of basalt that has been extruded into water. People find this around the Hawaiian Islands. When the volcanoes produce enough lava to go into the ocean, there are divers that go and take underwater photographs, and you have a special kind of rock that is formed, pillow lava. So we know that this was extruded underwater. This material was hot at one time and extruded underwater, and it cooled off to give us this particular shape. Hardly any sediment on there, interestingly enough. And yet by the time you get closer to the continents, you have thousands of feet of sediment. And you have a continuous increase in the depth of sediments as you go from divergent zones towards the continents, as one would expect. But that isn't all. One of the real breakthroughs of studying the ocean was to recognize the magnetic field that is inherent in the rocks at the bottom of the ocean. That is the crust upon which you have the ocean. Let me illustrate. Up here you have Iceland, and just a little bit to the southwest of Iceland, a region of the crust of the ocean right around the Mid-Atlantic Ridge was examined for remnant magnetism. That is to say, what magnetism would be left in the rocks. And what was found, as is illustrated by this blow-up under here, what was found is along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the magnetism in the rocks was oriented exactly in the same direction as the present Earth's magnetism. But interestingly enough, as the magnetic data were taken, moving in parallel away from the ridge, they found these stripes, and what the stripes represent is different orientation of the Earth's magnetic field. Basically, what I mean is the following. Every place you see a solid colored strip, the magnetic field in the rocks is oriented in exactly the same direction the Earth's present magnetic field. The lighter colors in between represent the magnetic field that's oriented in the opposite direction. So as you go away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, what you find is parallel to the ridge, at equal distances from the ridge, a reversal of the magnetic field that's in the rocks. Question, how are we going to explain this? Best way to explain it is to say that the magnetism in the rocks was produced by the Earth's magnetic field. We all know that the Earth acts like a big magnet with a north pole and a south pole. And if you were to take a little compass and put it anywhere on the Earth's surface, you'll find that the compass needle will orient itself north and south, pretty much, along what we call the field lines of the magnetic poles, like so. Now, what has happened is the following. The area around the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, where the rock was coming out, produced molten rock. As the rock cooled, various crystals precipitated out of the rock. They crystallized. And different crystals crystallized at different temperatures. For example, if I had a mixture of chicken fat and water, and the water was around boiling, and you began to cool the mixture, first you find this chicken fat that solidifies, and then you'd find the water would solidify if you brought it down below freezing. Same thing occurs when you cool rock. Different minerals will crystallize at different temperatures. And one of the first minerals to crystallize is a material called magnetite. And as the name implies, it is a magnetic crystal. And this little magnetic crystal acts like a compass. And it lines up according to the Earth's magnetic field. And so as the material begins to come out of the rift zone of a divergent zone and begins to cool, magnetite crystals form, and the magnetite crystals are able to orient themselves according to the Earth's magnetic field. Now what happens? As the magma cools, the other crystals crystallize out, the magma hardens, and the magnetite crystals now are frozen in one direction, and they begin to move away from the mid-Atlantic ridge. Now all of a sudden, what happens is you have a reversal in the Earth's magnetic field. Every so often, the Earth's magnetic field pulls a flip on us. North becomes south, and south becomes north. When that flip happens, the magnetite that is formed in subsequent upwelling of magma at the divergent zone is going to have an opposite orientation. And so what you have coming away from the divergent zone is almost like a magnetic tape that records the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. And what you see, then going back to the previous diagram, what you see is a record of the magnetic fields of the Earth that is flipping at various times. Now, I should say this doesn't only happen here in the ocean, it also happens on land. In fact, it was first discovered on land when people went to volcanoes that had repeated eruptions over a long period of time, and what they found is that the magnetite in the lava was oriented in different directions for different layers. They were able to date the rocks, find the correlation between the reversal of magnetic fields, and then when they went to the dating of the rocks in the ocean's crust and looked at the reversals of the magnetic field, they found that it matched exactly what was happening on land. Now, how are you going to explain this? A very good way of explaining it is the way we just used, and that is you have a divergent zone. The magnetic crystals of magnetite are lining up in directions that match the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. And as the Earth's magnetic field flips, these magnetite crystals are being aligned in different orientations. That, I say, is very, very powerful evidence that you actually have a divergent zone. That material really is coming up and spreading at the zone. Here's a little bit what it looks like. Okay, earlier time you have this, the material comes out, you have the magnetic field freezing in one direction. A little later time, this material has moved out, more material comes up, freezes in a different direction, and this continues. And then finally what you do is you build up a whole series of magnetic lines, magnetic directions, as you move away from the divergent zone. It was this evidence that changed more minds concerning continental drift, plate tectonics, than any other evidence. This, by the way, is very much the kind of work that Jay Tuzel Wilson was doing. It's not only in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that you find this, but also there are some spreading zones that you find right off the U.S. and Canada, and you find the same series of stripes that occur in that location as well. And if you do this worldwide, basically what you see here is the East Pacific Rise version of what happens over here in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It is common throughout all the rifting zones, and the age determinations as you move away from the rifts turns out to be the same in all of these regions. That is to say, if you move out from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge a certain distance where the magnetic field has switched direction 5 times and measure the age, and then go to the East Pacific Rise and move out where the Earth's magnetic field has switched 5 times and measure the age of those rocks, even though they're farther apart from the rift, they still have the same age. And that becomes very powerful evidence as to the reality of these spreading zones. One more concerning magnetic fields. Not only is it possible to check out the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field as one moves away from the rift valley, but checking various rock types in different continents, one is also able to build up the position of the North Pole on the Earth in the past. And what the top map shows is where the North Pole would be in, through various times in the past on the basis of rocks collected in North America and over here in Eurasia. Now basically what you have is the following. By looking at the orientation of the rocks, of the field of the rocks, you can show where the North Pole would be. What is interesting is, if the continents had remained in their present position throughout the last 230 million years, then we would have had two North Poles in the past. We only have one North Pole at present. Now, if you go away from this point where the North Pole is at present, what you find as you get farther and farther back in time, apparently the Earth's pole split in two. Well, there's no theoretical reason to believe that you would have two North Poles. There are great theoretical reasons to believe you only had one North Pole in all time. However, if you take the continents and put them together in the past, and then check to see where the North Pole should have been, then you find a convergence of the North Pole as determined by the American rocks, and the North Pole as determined by the Eurasian rocks. Then you only have one North Pole that just switches around in location. But that's okay, because even now we know that the North Magnetic Pole does not stay put. It tends to mix, it tends to shift around as well. Actually, the situation is even more complicated. If you were to take the position of the North Pole, not only of America and Eurasia, but a number of other continents, then you have a multiplicity of North Poles that are wandering all over the place in the past. However, if you check to see where the North Pole would be, according to where the position of the continents would be in the past, you wind up with one North Pole. And this is more magnetic evidence that continents have really shifted. Well, what about some modern measurements of motion? I mentioned Iceland. Actually, Iceland is part of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that sits on top of the ocean. And interestingly enough, when you measure the ages of rocks in Iceland, you find that right in the middle of Iceland, this band is the youngest, and then it moves out through older and older rocks. Interestingly enough, the very center of Iceland, this darker color, is where you have active volcanoes today. Not only that, but the Icelanders are also very interested in volcanoes and earthquakes. After all, they have to live with them. And so what they have done is set up metering stations on various parts of the island, and what they do is they send laser beams across this region, and by measuring the time that it takes the laser pulse to get to a reflector and back, they're able to measure the distance, and over the course of a few years, they can actually measure that the island is expanding. And the reason it's expanding is because right here is a divergent zone, and as the material comes up, it is pushing the rest of the island apart, and that particular motion can be measured on Iceland. And again, it turns out to be a few inches a year. It matches the historical value. You wouldn't think that radio astronomy gets into the act, but it does. Astronomers try to get into everything they can. Radio telescopes are very much like optical telescopes. They have this curved mirror, except they pick up radio waves instead of light waves. And the interesting thing is that if you put two telescopes together, you're going to pick up two signals. These signals can be fed together and mixed. They can be added together. Now, think with me for a moment. Suppose the blue signal here represents what's coming from the left antenna, and the red signal represents what's coming from the right antenna. And the signals now are separated the way they are because the signal has reached one antenna before it has reached the other antenna. And so the signal from this antenna has come to this mixer a little before the signal of the other antenna, but the signals are added together. Now, suppose you move the antenna on the right. Basically, that will change the time that the signal gets from the red antenna into the mixer, and when that signal is added to the one coming from the blue antenna, it'll be a little different than what it was before. Now, what does this have to say about continental drift? Astronomers not only put two antennas together, but they mix a number of antennas. They're able to mix the signal. And they're able to mix the signal from antennas on different continents. And so what has happened is antennas have been aimed towards very, very distant astronomical objects from America and from Europe, and the signals have been mixed. And then a year later, 2 years later, they'll make exactly the same measurements. The antenna hasn't moved by itself, but the continent upon which it is located has moved. And as a result of the movement of the continent, the signal is going to be mixed in a little different way than what it was in previous years. And believe me, we can tell differences between two antennas that are several thousand miles apart using this technique. We can tell distances have changed on the order of a few inches. And so radio astronomers have actually been able to measure the separation of Europe and North America. And again, it comes out to this 2.5 inch per year. This is a real-time measurement. This is something that can be done year after year, and you can see the separation that occurs. Not only that, but optical signals are also used. When the astronauts landed on the moon, they left reflectors on the moon. So lasers on Earth could bounce signals off the reflectors and measure the time that it took the signals to get back and forth. By doing that, and using lasers on different continents, they were able to measure the separation of the continents with a technique that's very similar to what the radio astronomers use. And again, we find that the continents are presently separating. And then if that isn't all, satellites that have a load of reflectors on them are also orbiting the Earth, the so-called radio satellites. Again, lasers are used to bounce beams off the satellites. And by correlating the motion of a satellite with the time that it takes the beams to bounce off the satellites and come back to Earth, again, the motion of the continents can be detected, and again turns out to be very similar to the historical value of several inches separation between North America and Europe. Well, let me just wind things up by showing you a little bit what the continents looked like in the past. We'll read from top to bottom. Here's when they were pretty much together. Here they're beginning to separate. Up here we're talking about, can't really see the numbers here, but 160 million years, and we're getting more and more towards the present. Just a mere 65 million years ago, the continents looked like this. Here they are at present. If you extrapolate what is happening, in about 50 million years, the continents will look like so. And one of the big changes that will have taken place is the Baja Peninsula will be up around Oregon as a result of the movement of the transform boundary there. You will find that the separation of the continents will be greater, and Africa is going to undergo a major change as this Rift Valley in Africa begins to open up and the sea will come in, and you will have an inland sea in Africa as opposed to just a very deep gash in the earth that you have now that is called the Rift Valley. Continental movement, plate tectonics, has allowed us to understand why earthquakes occur in some zones and not in others. Here's a result of earthquakes. One of the major difficulties of an earthquake is fires and landslides and, of course, the destruction due to the shaking. It helps us understand why volcanoes occur in some locations and not others. These features occur primarily, these activities occur primarily along plate boundaries. It helps us understand why we have extremely contorted rocks in many mountains and why these rocks contain fossils that are of sea living creatures. It's not because Noah's flood put them up there. It is because this material that was once very deep as sediment in the ocean has been pushed up as a result of the thrusting together of the continental plates and now sits many thousands of feet above the ocean. And you see the contortions that show the enormous forces that must be involved to form continents. Here's another picture of contortions of what was rock once underneath the ocean that now is part of a mountain. Some of the most spectacular sights that we see like this are a combination of the uplifting that has taken place due to continental motion and also then glaciation that tears some of the material apart and gives you these nice jagged peaks. This area is around Harrisburg. It's a Landsat photo, satellite photo that has been taken. You notice the enormous folds that you find. That's typical of the Appalachian Range. This is also because of continental drift. Because what happened before the continents separated some 230 million years ago, what was Africa and Europe and the Americas came together, shown in the upper four panels, and then they split apart, but the split was not where they came together. And if you examine the Appalachians very carefully, especially down around the Carolinas, what you will find is pieces of Africa that are stuck to the North American continent as a result of the last separation. It's always a puzzle. Why does that part of North America look like Africa? And the answer is because of the collision that took place before the separation. Continental drift helps us explain other features of other planets. A big gash here on Mars, not created by water, but this length is the distance from New York to Los Angeles, and it's about a tenth as wide. What caused it? Probably on Mars what happened initially is plates formed and began to pull apart, but Mars being a small planet has cooled off, so there's no longer molten material under the surface to keep the motion going. And what you have here is beginning continental drift here on Mars. Pictures that look very much like the Afar region in Africa. Here's this big gash in the earth that continues up the Red Sea and up through the Dead Sea, right up into Syria, up to the Taurus Mountains. And this particular gash is where a beginning rift is occurring. A divergent zone is occurring. And that appears to be what has happened on Mars. We find a similar kind of thing. I was going to say you're going to see a similar thing on Venus, but you can't really see this photograph. But right between these craters, there is, again, a gash that is forming that looks very similar to what we find here on Earth. So continental drift helps us understand a little bit more what's happening on solid bodies of the solar system. And with that, I will end. I was going to say a little bit about some of the problems in here on the continental drift. But let me just mention, that'll take about 2 minutes to do this. Because of earthquake activity, we have been able to determine the structure of the Earth. And what we have is a central core that is very dense and solid, an outer core that is also very dense but liquid, and they have a huge mantle, and right on the surface you have a very, very narrow crust that looks a little bit like an eggshell. And one of the big questions in continental drift theory, plate tectonics theory, is where is the circulation of the molten material that spreads these plates and brings them together? Where are these big convection loops, these circulation loops located? Are they up near the surface of the Earth in what is known as the asthenosphere, which is in the upper mantle? Do the loops really come all the way down to the core? Are they huge? Do we have what are known as thermal hotspots and plumes that arise and then have a lot of motion in different areas that come back down towards the core? Instead of having these big circulation loops, do we just have one big upwelling zone and then a bunch of downwelling zones? We don't know. That's one of the questions. And another question is continental roots. Some people feel that the continents are too deep to be moved. That is a question that needs further investigation. When you have an area like our Rockies, whatever material you see on top of the Earth, you have that much material and more going down into the Earth. It's a little bit like an iceberg, where you only see about 10% of the ice exposed above water. 90% is underwater. When it comes in the continents, about a third is on top and about two-thirds is down below. And what it means is if you have a mountainous area like the Rockies, what you see on top, multiply by two, and that's what you've got down below. And some people feel that these continental roots may actually go down too deep, that they should anchor the plate rather than move along with the plate. That has to be examined. And then finally, we also find that there are earthquake zones that are away from plate margins. One of the classic areas is in the U.S., in the New Madrid region, around Memphis, Tennessee. Severe earthquake that occurred in the 1800s. Charleston had a severe earthquake in the 1800s. The Niagara Falls region is an earthquake zone, and these zones are not near plate boundaries. Why do we have earthquakes there? The best answer seems to be that we have fossil boundaries. That is to say, through all the period of Earth's history, you've had a continuous crashing together and pulling apart of plates. And perhaps what we have is a remnant boundary that has been covered over And every now and then, these boundaries that are frozen down underneath the continents shift and move. And that is what produces earthquakes. So all the earthquakes in the U.S. aren't out west. Some of them can also be in the east, in the Mississippi, Niagara, and down in the Charleston region. And again, these are areas of investigation. But for the most part, on the basis of the evidence that I've shown, I think we can safely say that there is a great deal of evidence in favor of what we call continental drift and plate tectonics. When you tie it all together, we have a nice coherent theory that explains many, many features on the Earth. And the nice thing about this theory is it ties so many disciplines together in a nice, coherent whole. And as a result of that, unless something else comes that completely overthrows the theory, it seems to me that the theory of continental drift for plate tectonics has a lot going for it. It should be accepted, and other investigations that are made in geology somehow are going to have to fit into that particular theory. And with that, I will end, and I thank you for your kind attention, even though we went over time.